Hello and welcome to the program. Now, I'm down here today with Paul Comrie Thompson from our sister program, Counterpoint, and we're... Actually, I don't know why we're down here and where we are exactly. Where are we, Paul?
We're 60 metres below the basement of the ABC Sydney headquarters in Ultimo. The walls in here are 4 metres thick, reinforced concrete. Now, as you know, Anthony, like you, I'm partial to a good conspiracy. So I thought you and your audience should know about this place.
Well, I had no idea all this existed. It's dark down here, but I can see another door. Where does that lead?
Oh, this is just the foyer. There's a whole network of rooms through here.
What's with all the food tins in the corner?
Stockpiling. They brought enough supplies down here to last 6 months.
They? Who's they? What is this place exactly?
This is the ABC's emergency Y2K shelter.
Y2K?
Donald McDonald had it built back in the late 1990s, when he was chairman.
Well, that explains all the Opera Australia posters.
On the last day of 1999, the board of the ABC and the entire senior management team took shelter in here awaiting the coming apocalypse.
The Y2K bug?
Exactly.
But Armageddon never came.
That's why Mark Scott's ordered it sealed forever. It's an embarrassment. We're the first people down here in 10 years and we'll be the last.
Wow.
OK, look, come through here and I'll show you the sauna and billiards room, the putting range, the wine cellar.
Yes, it's Y2K today, as we bring you the second instalment in our irregular series called Getting It Wrong, with a question mark, where we take predictions from the past and test how accurate they turned out to be. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, back from the bunker.
In dead of winter, at the stroke of midnight, January 1st, 2000, elevators may stop, heat may vanish, credit cards and ATMs may cease to function, airplanes and trains may come to a halt.
That's actor Leonard Nimoy, back in the late 1990s, narrating a video about the problems the world might soon face because of the Y2K bug. He even went on to talk about the possibility of nuclear power plants suddenly closing down and international stock markets crashing. But don't misunderstand, the video wasn't just a catalogue of potential disasters. Elsewhere on the tape, there were also some handy tips for survival.
Fill every container that you use, milk, juice, soda pop, rinse it out and fill it with fresh tap water and store containers in a cool, dark place. I have containers all over my house, all over my yard. I have them in the bedroom. I have them in the linen closet. Store them, store them, store them. And now let's talk about storing water for purposes other than drinking.
Okay, we don't need to hear that. For those not old enough to remember, the Y2K bug was a glitch, which it was said would see computers right across the world fail or face serious problems when the date changed on the 1st of January 2000. It's easy to forget just how much hysteria there was back in the late 90s about Y2K, or the Millennium Bug as it was also called. And lest any revisionists try to suggest that it was only the doomsayers who went overboard, here's the ABC's own AM program from the 1st of December 1999.
With just a month to go before the Millennium Bug rears its head, the word from the Foreign Affairs Department is that Russia is a no-go zone for Australians. While some disruptions are predicted in other countries, only Russia is the subject of a warning against non-essential travel. Fiona Reynolds reports from Canberra.
If the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade is right, Russia is the last place you'd want to be at the start of the new millennium. Australians are being advised to put off travelling to Russia during the rollover period unless it's essential. And of the 14 embassy staff in Moscow, only 3 will remain to assess the impact of the Y2K bug.
All right, well, that's probably enough backgrounding for now. Let's get into the discussion. Joining us to chew over fact and fiction is Professor John Quiggin, the Australian Research Council Fellow in Economics and Political Science at Queensland University, Kate Carruthers, a Senior Social Business Consultant at Headshift Australasia, a social computing consultancy, and Paul Wallbank, a broadcaster, writer and speaker on how technology is changing society. Paul, Kate and John, welcome.
Hello.
Hi there.
Hi.
Paul, let's start with you and an opening provocation. How much of the Y2K phenomenon was real and how much was nonsense? And, 50-50, 10%, 90%? Where would you sit it?
I would say maybe 20% real and 80% hype and snake oil.
All right, now explain why.
First of all, we should be clear that we're looking at this with hindsight. Back then, we didn't know. It really was one of those Rumsfeldian unknown unknowns. That at the time, I was running an IT support business, and we were going in and looking at small to medium businesses. And we were finding around about 8% of computers were having some sort of problem, which back then, the accounting packages and that were very, very flaky. And if your clock went back to 1900, and that was actually part of the problem, was that you didn't really know with some of these cheaper computers what they would do, and some of them would go to 1903, some would go to 2027. Some very odd, out of left field things would happen. There was also an interesting thing that we found with it too, was that it was the later computers, the 486 and early Pentiums, that were having the problem, because these were the early commoditized computers. The older 286 and 386s tended actually to cruise through all of this. But on the other hand, there was a lot of hype and a lot of people really pushing the barrows. We saw a lot of consultants make a lot of money out of hysteria, basically, selling fear, uncertainty and doubt.
Kate Carruthers, let's bring you in. Your percentage, where would you put it?
I'm sort of in the same region as Paul, and I take the same view that with hindsight we know it was less of a problem than it was potentially looking at it in the day. The thing was that there were a number of people who were predicting the end of the world as we know it, and we didn't know if that was actually the case or not, because people were asking, people like me, I was an IT manager at the time in a big corporate, and they were asking me for assurance that things wouldn't break, and all I could say was, maybe they will, maybe they won't, we'll have to test.
Well, we forget that that staff were actually evacuated from the Russian embassy, from the Australian embassy in Russia, by the Australian government, because they were fearful of what might actually happen.
I think by then that was just hype, ill-informed hype. What we didn't know at the time was much earlier when we were thinking about it. We were thinking about these issues in 1998, the IT professionals. By 2000, we were pretty comfortable. We knew what was going to break and what wasn't, and it was all sorted.
Is it correct, Kate, that while many people focused on, you know, what would happen when we entered the year 2000, when the clocks rolled over into the year 2000, there were actually other dates that were more important from an IT perspective that occurred leading up to the year 2000?
Yes, a big problem for us in financial services was that in the olden days, back in the 70s when a lot of those systems were built, the date for never was 9/9/99, and that came up in September the 9th, 99, and we had to test to make sure our systems would work for that. So a lot of date calculations were suddenly going to be screwed up if those fields weren't fixed. And that was actually a bigger problem for a lot of financial systems than 2000.
John Quiggin, let's get your percentage, because yours is going to be different, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd say about 5% reality, 95% hype.
Okay. Well, let's go with that. Let's go with that 5% reality. What was real about it?
Well, it was a genuine bug, as Kate said. There are a bunch of things that can go wrong that are to do with dates, and that's a problem with computers. But if you looked at the kind of discussion that people were having, it was as if a computer failing due to a bug was going to bring down civilization as we know it. Well, certainly then, even today, you know, the computers I had then crashed every day.
Is it right that it was more of an issue in the English-speaking world, in English-speaking countries? And if that is the case, why was that the case?
Well, just the way in which cultural messages flow. The English-speaking world has fads which take a long while to translate into other languages. By the time people in Italy were even thinking about the problem, it was already late 1999, too late to do anything much about it. And indeed, anybody who was looking at the numbers could already tell by then that there wasn't going to be a significant problem, because so many of the critical dates had already passed with very modest disruptions.
Now, I've seen the articles that you wrote back in 1999 and earlier. What was the response to those articles at that time, if we take us back there? Because lots of politicians, I mean, they were really on board, weren't they?
I think everybody was. As I say, it really was the perfect storm. There was no incentive for anybody in a position of authority to challenge this and say, let's not spend this money, because, of course, if something did happen, you would have big problems. As it was, huge amounts, $12 billion in Australia was spent, and nobody paid any sort of price for that. So I guess there was really no response to my articles, except I calculated how much my share of that $12 billion was and made sure I got paid at least that much for debunking the whole idea.
Kate Carruthers, do you want to jump in there?
There's two things. Yeah, I do. There were two things that this actually drove, and this was actually a global good thing. I know John sees it as a bad thing, but companies had failed to invest in their key capital infrastructure, which was technology, for a very long time. Many of the systems running big businesses were from the 1970s. And there was no impetus for the organisations to invest their capital to improve those systems or to replace them. And Y2K was actually, even though it turned out to be not so much of a problem as had been originally thought by some people, it was actually a huge productivity leap forward for technology within organisations. So it actually had a benefit to the global systems world. So you can't ignore that. And the fact is that we as technology professionals were being asked for assurance that things would not go wrong. Mm. And unless you test for the problems, you can't assure people that they won't occur.
Paul Warbank, would you agree with Kate there? I mean, if there were the benefits that Kate says, they were very costly benefits, though, weren't they? I mean, $12 billion in Australia and, you know, estimates of $500 billion spent worldwide.
Kate's point about the lack of investment really does nail that, though, that for the previous 10 years, we really seriously underinvested in those systems. And that showed in those older programs with two-digit date fields and that. They really should have gone in the mid-1990s. We also should keep in mind, too, that in perspective, remember we had the dot-com boom at the same time as well, and vastly more amounts of money were spent on that. So mixing it all up together, I think the numbers aren't quite so straightforward. And we should also keep in mind for the IT industry, it was actually turned out to be a disaster because what happened was we brought forward a lot of investment as well. And with the dot-com bust and then in Australia with the GST reinvestments, because a lot of businesses had to upgrade their systems to deal with the GST in the middle of 2000, we ended up with probably 5 years of investment brought forward and massive unemployment in the IT industry for the next 2 years as a consequence. So for the IT professionals, it was actually a perfect storm, not a perfect opportunity.
John Quiggin, what about that point? Because there is a perception now, isn't there, that... Yes, it was, you know, a mass hysteria, or there was an element of hysteria about it all, but that the IT people, the IT companies, did very well out of it, thank you very much. You know, Paul seems to be suggesting that that really wasn't the case.
Well, I mean, the first point is all of this is to some extent like defending the space program on the basis that it gave us non-stick fry pans. I mean, it did, but if you wanted non-stick fry pans, there were cheaper ways to get it. As Paul said, it did bring forward some investment, and that had both good short-term consequences, but also some bad consequences. I did write at the time even that upgrading systems would be a side benefit. And I think there was a further benefit, which was that organisations started to take disaster planning seriously, some of which hadn't done so in the past. So we certainly got some benefits out of it, but not nearly as many as if we'd approached the whole thing on the basis of actual information rather than, as Kate says, a demand for complete assurance. And I think one of the crucial things about Y2K was indeed that by spending all this money, you could get complete assurance. This was one bug that you could absolutely eliminate, whereas in general, computer bugs can't be eliminated. If somebody asked an IT professional to say, guarantee me that this computer system won't fail, you know, they would just be laughed at, whereas guarantee me it won't fail at midnight on New Year's Eve can be done with enough money.
And this is Future Tense, and today we're talking to Professor John Quiggin, Australian Research Council Fellow in Economics and Political Science at the University of Queensland, Paul Warbank, who's a broadcaster, writer and speaker on how technology is changing society, and Kate Carruthers, Senior Social Business Consultant at Headshift Australasia. And we're talking about the Y2K bug and how real it was as a prediction of what was going to happen in the future. Kate, litigation. How much of the Y2K bug phenomena was driven by the fear that companies and governments had of potential litigation in the future?
Oh, a huge amount of it. And that was one of the typical ways that IT professionals would get the attention of their executive and board, drawing their attention to liability issues and having those kind of discussions to frame the requirement for investment in the assurance process, the testing and the refactoring of the systems. And that really drove a lot of the thinking from senior people.
Paul Warbank, was litigation an issue?
Oh, absolutely. Right across the board, from the small businesses right to the big businesses. It's interesting what John says about the English-speaking countries, because we see that common thread there, that we've got these very litigious common law systems, and that, I think, was the real driver between the different economies, that those of us in those English-speaking common law countries, we were much more attuned to litigation. And Kate's point about that was the way that IT people finally got the attention of management was very, very true, and that could have been part of the reason for the relatively mild exaggeration by IT professionals, that they were finally getting the attention and the investment that they had been so longly desiring from senior management. On the other hand, the snake oil merchants, they were just peddling fear, uncertainty and doubt there, and using the litigation was a very, very good stick to be hitting people with, that if you don't buy our gizmo that's going to fix your BIOS problems or whatever, you might get sued. And there were quite a few people selling that sort of snake oil.
John Quiggin, given that it was such an important issue at the time, and it was everywhere, you just couldn't escape it in the media, politicians talking about it, as I mentioned, departments were set up, or agencies were set up within governments here in the US, in Britain and in other countries to deal with Y2K. We had major companies investing lots of money in all of these. There was no real international post-evaluation, though, was there? That seems strange, given how much effort was put in up to the year 2000.
Well, there was virtually nothing. The Australian government or the Senate produced a report called Putting the Bug to Bed, which was about 5 pages long, which for a $12 billion program is not much of an evaluation. And the US Y2K authority produced something only marginally more, with listing of things like bus ticket programs that had malfunctioned in Bratislava and a few things of that kind. But there really was nothing, and I think it really reflects the same culture of blame in some sense that drove the thing in the first place. Afterwards, as long as everybody agreed just to quietly forget about it, no one was going to be asked, why did you spend all that money on something that now appears unrelated? And I mean, it's very appropriate indeed, it's post-New Year. It's the kind of thing, after the New Year's party, everybody quietly agrees to forget what went on and just walk away.
And Kate, there was a period of amnesia, though, afterwards, wasn't there? I know you said that there were benefits that came out of it, but there was a period for quite a few years there where it just disappeared off the radar. People just didn't talk about what had happened. Was there a sense of embarrassment at some of the more outlandish spending and more outlandish claims that were made?
There are three things. One, there was the sharks in suits, the consultants who were the scaremongers and who were getting in there and trading on fear, uncertainty and doubt, and they just disappeared overnight. Don't know where they went. Mm-hmm. Haven't run into many of them since.
They became the social media experts.
I'm sure they did. The other thing was that for the IT professionals, they swung in Australia straight into getting ready for goods and services tax. And there was no breath for us to take between, OK, we survived New Year's Eve, OK, quick, now start working out what we have to do to fix the systems for GST. But the people I loved were nothing to do with all of this business stuff. But there was people like Stan and Holly Deo, who had a world crisis and calamity website where they would talk about predictions of disaster and recommended stocking up on guns and bullets and canned food and toilet paper. Mm-hmm. And for me, these conspiracy-driven sites, I used to love looking at them because they were so entertaining. But there were lots of people who did that. There were even people in Australia I knew who had a pile of toilet paper and some canned food in the basement.
Well, certainly the canned food one was interesting. As I pointed out at the time, the canned food had expiry dates, which, if you believed the general stories, the computer should have been incapable of calculating since right. That was after 2000. But the apocalyptic stuff was driven by the notion that all these embedded systems in things like airplanes, lifts and so forth were all crucially dependent on getting the date right. Now, why any of these things would ever need to know the date was unclear. But so you got all those kinds of things, and you got predictions of monetary chaos and things like that. And indeed, there was a big expansion in the money supply in case automatic teller machines didn't work. So you had sort of second round predictions.
And Paul Warbank, a strange prediction that sticks in your mind?
There's none specifically. I mean, there's all the general ones of the aircraft crashing out of the sky, which John's just mentioned, the ATM networks crashing. And it was that general atmosphere of the end of the millennium. I think that a lot of the extreme left field, that was the case. That just as in, I'm sure in 1999 there were people in sackcloth predicting all manner of calamity and locusts and so on. this was the modern high-tech version of that, that the sackcloth wearers were stashing their guns and ammo and baked beans and beer in the basement and expecting all of civilization to fall around the ears. I don't think that was really the IT industry's view of the world, though, but that was certainly the extreme views. And I think for them, the Y2K bug was just another convenient hook to be hanging their fears upon.
And just to finish off with you, John, moral panic. I mean, there was also that sort of, there was almost a religious nature to all
of this. Well, clearly there are a bunch of people out there who were actually, of course, looking forward to the collapse of civilization as we know it. And the other thing which is characteristic of these millennial movements is there was, for quite a few years, a little subculture of people who said civilization really had crashed and the authorities were just keeping it secret. Which,
right.
and so they absolutely characteristic of millennial movements, that they announce the day and nothing happens. And one characteristic response to say, yes, it really did happen, but only the enlightened can see the disaster that's unfolding.
And Kate Carruthers, just to take us out, could Y2K, could that ever happen again?
Yes, in the year 10,000.
Okay, all right. Yeah.
Well, we should keep in mind
the Y10K bug. It's coming soon. Keep an eye out for it.
Well, we should keep in mind there were a few kludges used on spreadsheets and databases moving the dates to 2029 and that sort of thing. So we could get a mini Y2K in 2029.
All right. Look, thank you very much to all of you today for joining us for that discussion. Professor John Quiggin, Australian Research Council Fellow in Economics and Political Science at the University of Queensland. Kate Carruthers, Senior Social Business Consultant at Headshift Australasia. And Paul Warbank, broadcaster, writer and speaker on how technology is changing society. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The millennial bug jeopardizes our way of life in ways never imagined. Thousands of programmers working round the clock may not fix this problem in time. Such potential mass confusion confirms end-time prophecy. The impending worldwide panic could signal the end of this age and Christ's glorious return. With only months before the moment arrives, you must have the information found in this shocking video, 2000 Time Bomb. To order, call toll-free 1-800-918-5577. We'll send this emergency video for a gift of only $24.95, plus $3 shipping and handling.
What can you say? The end of the world is nigh, and they're still pumping the faithful for money. A U.S. televangelist ad from 1999.